Aloha, welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Today we hear about a new energy program from the Hawaiian Council. Can it reduce costs for those who need it the most? Mental health has been a quiet topic in Hawaii's construction industry. We hear about contractors who are ready to start talking about it. We look at a new artificial intelligence tool that creators hope will make it easier to measure sea levels. What else can it do? And this week's Manu Minute, we introduce you to a non-native bird known for its gobbles. It's not who you think it is. Plus, we meet a high school teacher who started a student club called, wait for it, Worms. It's about a lot more than the slimy creatures. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. The Trump administration has dramatically shifted federal policy on clean energy and climate resilience. Experts say that could raise electricity bills. A new initiative from the Hawaiian Council wants to help homeowners reduce their energy burden, which is already the highest in the nation, and make local homes more resilient to climate disasters. HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote has been reporting on this. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning.
So to start off, you report on climate and energy, as we all know, and over the last year, you've been following what federal changes on those fronts means for Hawaii. Can you paint a picture for us?
Yeah. So there have been some really big changes. And I think it's important first to understand that the Biden administration pumped record levels of funding into clean energy and climate initiatives. And a lot of that was part of the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed in 2022. And it was widely considered to be one of the most significant climate spending bills in history. It put hundreds of millions of dollars towards clean energy incentives, as well as programs to try to make energy cheaper for working families. And now the Trump administration, its posture is profoundly different. So, for instance, a recent major spending bill spearheaded by Republicans that was signed into law by President Trump in July rolled back a lot of those incentives. And the Trump administration has also cut IRA-funded programs like Solar for All, for instance, which was designed to lower energy costs for working families through community solar projects. So Hawaii was slated to get $68 million in funding for that program. That's been terminated. The Attorney General's office is in the process of reviewing that.
Yeah, that's a really hard 180-degree turn. So how is the state responding?
So a lot of this has been happening very quickly. People are still kind of getting their ducks in a row. And there has been a lot of concern from state actors because Hawaii has ambitious climate goals and our energy costs are already so high. We have seen the state take some big steps. So one that's been talked about a lot is that lawmakers passed the green fee this spring. That's going to put more revenue towards conservation and energy programs, perhaps. We don't know exactly what that will be for. The state has also filed a lawsuit against big oil companies for deceptive marketing practices around climate change. That could bring untold amounts of money to the state if they are successful. But lawsuits, you know, take a long time. We're looking at a years and years long runway. And so these things haven't really filtered down yet to provide benefit to individual households that are struggling with energy costs right now. But there's a new program that wants to take more of a bottom-up approach to these challenges of high energy costs and climate change. That program is called Kalahiki. It's an initiative from the Hawaiian Council, which was formerly known as the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement. And it's led by Josh Stanbrough. So he worked in climate policy in Washington, D.C. for the last few years. And he kind of watched this transition in federal climate and energy policy firsthand.
And honestly, there was a pipeline of hundreds of millions of dollars that was going to benefit low and moderate income households here in Hawaii that are really struggling economically around these issues. You know, my experience working with those federal resources and seeing the promise and the potential that they held and then have them be pulled back at the last second really got me fired up about making sure that we are building local partnerships with local funding and local resources to solve the problems that our local households face.
And so Stanbro is now working on that mission in his new gig. Kalahiki is going to provide, kind of think of it as personalized case management to help households reduce their energy costs and also disaster-proof their homes. And Stanbro says a lot of that work will involve connecting people to state and local resources that are already available.
If you think about like cordage, there's, you know, lots of individual strands that are not that strong. But when you wind them all together, you get a rope you can lash a canoe with, you can lash a home together with, right? And what Kalahiki is doing is it's winding together all these different programs that on their own are difficult for people to access. Maybe they're not worth it for somebody to like go to five different websites, submit their paperwork five times for a small benefit. But when you wrap it all together, then it's much stronger and it actually can pay off for a household to do them all at one time, recapture those benefits and those costs and those savings. And so Hawaiian Council is trying to be that, to knit that cord and plug households in one time to the suite of benefits and programs that make sense in a linear way to make it as inexpensive as possible to get the most home resilience that you can possibly get given your situation.
Okay, so this sounds like one way for bringing down costs, but who's eligible for these services?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So this program is in its infancy. It really launched in the last month, though it's been in works for a while. And they're launching a pilot program of 80 households. They've got a dozen lined up so far. Right now, this program is limited to Oahu, though Stanbro hopes that it's going to expand in the future. And it's also focusing on Department of Hawaiian Homelands residents and properties to begin with.
And so how exactly does it work?
Yes. Okay. So you're a homeowner. You reach out to Kalahiki. They have a form on their website at HawaiianCouncil.org. You can also email kalahiki@HawaiianCouncil.org. You're accepted. And you first start by telling the case managers about your energy usage. So how many people live in your home? What times of day you use electricity? What kind of, you know, light bulbs and appliances you have? Everything like that. And then they'll give you a home energy audit to reduce your energy usage. So they say, you can switch out these light bulbs, or here's a rebate you can apply for to get a more efficient AC unit, things like that. Then they give that about a month to take to establish your new energy baseline. And when they figure out what your energy costs are when you've already made all these adjustments to lower your energy burden, then they start looking at bigger solutions. That's something like rooftop solar, right? And what they're saying is they want to figure out what's the smallest, most affordable system that people could put on their roofs that would meet their needs, and what state tax breaks or other opportunities might folks apply for that would make that more affordable. And Stanbro says that on top of this kind of bread and butter, how do we get people's electric bills to be more affordable? They also want to make homes more resilient. So can we get hurricane straps on your roof so that it doesn't fly off during high winds? Or could we cover vents with mesh to keep out embers during a wildfire? And Stanbro, he has this vision where every single house kind of becomes a resilience hub, and Hawaii's energy landscape is just more equitable overall.
We've seen solar adoption in a lot of wealthier neighborhoods in Hawaii over the past decade plus. And some folks are paying barely anything on their electric bill now. But the folks who need it the most, who are working two jobs and don't have the upfront resources to pay for that, have been locked out for a long time. And so that's what Kalahiki does, is it opens the door to those other folks that haven't yet got solar and need that backup energy security. More and more we are seeing, the grid being shut down during high wind events, during fire danger, and that instability can really lead to disruptions for families that have medical devices in their homes, freezer full of food that goes bad. And during fire episodes on the west side of this island, you see the grid go down and families gathering and aunties gathering in those homes that have solar on their roof and battery backup where they can charge their phones and get together and still be safe and secure. So really this is about energy sovereignty, but it's also about climate resilience.
Yeah, what really stood out to me is the opportunity to open the door to the folks who haven't had these kinds of opportunities before.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're hoping that they can bring those people in and think, okay, yes, the state has goals to achieve, you know, 100% renewable energy, but how are we making sure that every household is brought along the way?
All right. Well, we have lots to follow here. Thanks so much for joining us today, Savannah.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Check out our stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. There are some alarming figures regarding mental health in the construction industry. The field has one of the highest suicide rates of any profession. It's a national trend and one that concerns contractors here in Hawaii. A University of Hawaii study is on the way to examine the issue more closely. Noelle Fuji'i-Oredi wrote about this issue today for Overstory, and she's here to talk about it. Good morning, Noelle.
Good morning, DW. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for this really, really important story. I think a good place to start might be with giving listeners a sense of the numbers. What kind of scale are we talking here?
Yeah, so in terms of national numbers, in 2022, 5,200 construction workers in the U.S. died by suicide. And so that's about five times the number that die from work injuries. In terms of more mental health, in 2021, about 15% of U.S. construction workers reported anxiety or depression. And of those workers, 84% did not see a mental health professional in the last year. And so, like you were saying, DW, I mean, locally, there is some interest in, you know, what can we do locally to support our construction workers, just given these national statistics?
Right. And helping them, I think, starts with understanding the issues. What are some of the reasons, or at least our understanding of the reasons for these numbers?
Yeah. So research has found that, you know, work-related factors can play a role in someone's mental well-being. And for construction in particular, it is a very fast-paced and high-pressure field of work. And so folks are dealing with pressing deadlines, right? If one part or one phase of a project is delayed, that can compound and lead to a delay for the overall project completion. It can mean more overtime and time away from family. There's a lot of pressure also to get the job done right and get it done in a manner that's safe. And it's a lot of physical labor. I mean, right, you can get injured from it, but also you might be working in some extreme weather conditions, or weather in general has just gotten a lot hotter. We don't always have as much of the trade winds blowing. And then too, construction is a very cyclical industry. And so sometimes, right, you might not always know if there will be another job after this current one. And so that can lead to some stress as well.
Yeah, stress from a lot of different angles there that you included. There's a program on Kauai Island, right, to try to at least start to address this. Tell us about that.
Yes. So this is a program by a nonprofit called Ho'a Ke'olopono Trades Academy and Institute. So they have an internship program for teenagers and young adults on Kauai. And what they've been doing is incorporating mental wellness into their curriculum. So the executive director of Ho'a Ke'olopono, his background is in construction and education. And so he saw that, you know, going beyond just building the skills specifically for construction industry was key to setting up his interns for successful careers and fulfilling lives. And so for this curriculum, it's six components, and it touches on things from, you know, resilience, how physical health, relationships, and productivity can set the foundation for mental wellness, the mindsets and behavior patterns of effective people, work ethic, at getting in touch with one's identity and core values, and then putting it all together. So it's really a proactive, prevention-oriented approach so that these young adults have the skills that they need to handle any stresses or challenges that life throws at them, whether it's in the construction industry or outside of that part of their lives.
Yeah, and we're talking very young here, right? These are sort of, in some cases, minors just coming into adulthood, entering the workforce.
Yes, yes. So the age for their internship program is 17 to 24-year-olds.
Yeah, so it just goes to show that, and I think that redounds to the fact you mentioned earlier about so few seeking mental help, trying to establish early the importance of this. Tell us about this study that we can expect that's coming from the state and UH regarding this issue.
Yeah, so that study, it's going to be a partnership between UH and then the State Department of Health. And so they're going to be exploring suicide, like Hawaii-level suicide data, and whether there are any professions that have maybe higher risk. And so construction is one of those professions that they'll be looking at. If I remember correctly, they'll also be looking at farmers and first responders, and then I believe some other essential worker categories. And that study is expected to get underway next month.
All right. Well, that'll be something to follow closely, because obviously more information can help us here in terms of reaching these workers. Thank you so much for that, Noelle.
Yes, thank you.
That was Overstory editor Noelle Fujii Oredi talking about her story published today about the mental health crisis in the construction industry and its impact here in Hawaii. You can read her story at overstoryhawaii.org. And an important reminder, if you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or having thoughts of suicide, please contact Hawaii Cares 988 by calling or texting 988. The call center is available 24/7.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Looking for cool, unique experiences and events happening across our Hawaiian Islands? Let your new HPR besties show you the way. Introducing HPR's Social Club Newsletter. Every Wednesday, get the latest happenings straight to your inbox. Sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org/socialclub.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater, presenting An Evening with Phil Rosenthal, creator of Netflix's Somebody Feed Phil, this Friday, sharing stories from his life and career. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umaui, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
Today, we're strolling through a farmer's market and taking a look at fruit varieties in partnership with our friends at Trees for Honolulu's Future. There are very few fruits endemic to Hawaii. Nani, mountain apple, and banana were all canoe plants brought by Polynesian voyagers. Spanish horticulturalist Don Francisco de Paula Marin planted the first documented pineapple in 1813. And at farmers markets today, you can even find popular fruits from Southeast Asia, like mangosteen and soursop. For today's quiz, we're stuck on the alligator pear, believed to have first arrived in Hawaii around 1833 by way of ships. Farmers on the Big Island who tried to grow this buttery fruit were very successful, as the conditions of the Kona's coffee belt allowed this crop to flourish. Today, there are around 200 varieties grown in Hawaii, But for our quiz, we are looking for the name of one particular hybrid variety developed decades ago at what was then the University of Hawaii's Department of Horticulture. This fruit has leathery, smooth skin that ripens in the fall to a deep purple at maturity, and it's easy to peel. The flesh is thick and creamy, without fibers, and high in oil content. Here's a hint. One of our members, who lives in Kona, named their tree Derek. Do you know the name of this variety of fruit? Call 808-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right will win an HPR tote bag and a brand new deck of the card game Kumala'au, made by Trees for Honolulu's Future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Is there any escaping AI these days? Researchers at the University of Hawaii have a new tool that helps them explore complex geoscience data. Initially, it's been used to track sea levels on Earth, but the team behind it says it has the capacity to do so much more, including analyzing atmospheric conditions on Mars. Scientists recently published details about this AI tool in the Journal of Geophysical Research. We talked with Matthew Winlansky, a climate scientist who's part of the team that's brought this new tool into the world. He is the associate director of the University of Hawaii's Sea Level Center.
Really happy to be here and share about this new research that we're doing at University of Hawaii at the Sea Level Center. And it's a approach to connecting a powerful large language model like what powers ChatGPT with our data at the center. And we connect that language model to our data and then also provide it a computing space to work on. It's a contained environment. And what this creates is the opportunity for data scientists to begin asking questions to the computer in everyday language, having a conversation with the computer.
And let's take one big step back and give our listeners a sense of what kind of data we're talking about here that interacts specifically with the system that you're talking about.
Well, it's tide gauge data primarily. It's observations of the water levels relative to the coastline. And our center, to support NOAA's mission, we operate tide gauges around the world, about 90 tide gauges. These can be of small islands or continents. And as well as in Hawaii, we operate about a dozen tide gauges. And again, these are instruments to measure the water level relative to the coast. And you can imagine with having tide gauge stations around the world, all the different types of questions that can come in to our center, asking about the data, asking for help analyzing it, or just general science questions about it. And that was part of the inspiration for developing an assistant.
You know, it raises a kind of fun question in my own imagination. If we can go back to the Stone Ages or last year, as it were, what would a scientist have done with these questions before this technology?
Yeah, well, what we still do is write computer code to analyze the data. Scientists who work with large amounts of data need to be familiar with writing computer code. That can be in various coding languages. People go to school for a long time to learn that. And it does take a lot of time. Many folks are very good at it. I personally struggle, have some difficulties. And that, again, was some of the motivation for utilizing this emerging technology, which is exciting what's developed. If you've had a chance to experience chatting with ChatGPT, just like it converses in natural language, that same technology is excellent at writing computer code. And it can translate between a normal chat to switching into that computer language.
Yeah, so cutting out all kinds of time in terms of that writing of code. One other thing that stood out to me in reading about the technology is that the goal is to, quote, lower the barrier between geophysical data that you're talking about here and the people trying to understand it. Say more about that.
Yeah, well, scientists constantly are coming up with questions, conversing with their colleagues, discussing new hypotheses or new approaches to analyzing data. And the stumbling block has been the time that it takes to go back to the computer workstation and perform that analysis. That's writing computer code. And what we're beginning to explore is the possibility of utilizing this AI technology to assist the scientist with performing that analysis task. The key word there, though, is really the assistance aspect. It requires the scientist in the loop checking over the AI system's work, perhaps making suggestions to the AI, or taking input from the AI, new approaches to data analysis. That's something I've been particularly excited about, is when the AI system suggests improvements to my own workflow at the UHC Global Center.
What you're emphasizing there is that the technology is an assistant. It's not meant to be any sort of replacement. It's meant to assist the work that's being done. Why is that? Is it that we don't trust the technology to do the work all on its own, that we don't want the technology to do all of the work on its own? Why is it in that assist space?
Well, if the technology was there at the point where it could do this hard work all on its own, that would be wonderful. We could explore new science questions and just really take things to the next level or have more free time. But the technology is not there yet. It makes mistakes. If you've chatted with any of these chatbots, sometimes it will just do things that don't seem to make sense or that you could do much better. And that's really where the scientist in the loop can come into that workflow and work in tandem with the AI assistant.
Yeah, and really verify the information and the work that's being done.
That's right.
Because you reference sort of people's everyday use of iteration of large language model that they can apply in various forms of work and life. And I think that by doing that, lots of us have become familiar with this idea of hallucinations, right? And this is what you're speaking to, I think. Times when a system can make mistakes, sometimes big ones that seem to come out of left field. Are there systematic ways for dealing with those hallucinations with this technology?
There are, and this is something we're learning about. If I was to have a conversation with ChatGPT and ask it to do data analysis on our center's tie gauge observations, it would not do a very good job. It probably wouldn't even be able to find the data. But by taking this technology and connecting it in with our database and providing it custom instructions, almost like a user manual for working with our data, that's a way to constrain the responses to be real and based on actual data from our center. But again, the key thing is that it can and will make mistakes. It may perform an analysis that's not up to the standards of the science. And that's where, again, the scientist operating the assistant really needs to come in and check the work.
And it sounds like it's really a case-by-case basis. If a mistake or error is spotted, that's dealt with on a one-off basis.
It is. And at this stage, something that we've thought about as far as next steps with the research is incorporating a similar type of technology, AI systems, to supervise this tool. Perhaps it could come in and observe the workflow, the outputs, and help check it for mistakes. But at this stage, it's a step-by-step process with the scientist in the loop. That's part of the reason why we've made this available through a research publication. And it's not intended at this stage for general public, although welcome to check it out if they're interested.
So the technology is available to the general public, but not necessarily geared toward the general public at this stage.
That's right. It's geared for research scientists who are interested in exploring this technology. Perhaps they're curious about it. And also computer system developers who may be interested in taking this technology, the software framework, and adapting it for their own workflow. We encourage other developers to take this system and build on it, make it better. And this is one of the neat things of working in the university research environment, where everything that we do is made publicly available.
And thinking about that sort of forward-looking frame of mind, are there improvements that you're already eyeing that can be done? Are there dreams that you and your colleagues might have for how this technology can be improved?
Oh, for sure. This is early stages in the technology. If we just think back just a couple years ago, just to imagine having this conversation about chatting with a computer, that would be make-believe. So this is exciting times. This was a small project at UH. Myself and our software engineer, Nemanja Komar, developed it. And we're really encouraging others to take a look at this if they're interested, perhaps make suggestions, or just build upon it on their own if that's what they have expertise in.
Have you received any early feedback yet?
We have, and it's honestly mixed. Some of the most positive feedback has been from data scientists who see opportunities where it can take what would have maybe required a few hours or even a day of work and just bring it down to minutes, really, to do complex data analysis. But on the other hand, this application looks ChatGPT when you first start with it. It's just a blank screen with a place to ask a question. And if the user isn't already thinking about a question, or they ask it and it immediately comes back with a mistake, that's a stumbling block. And that's definitely an opportunity for improvement. One of the big things about this technology is its flexibility. So we released a prototype system for working with C-level data, but that's just an example. This is built so that it is connected to the internet, and by providing it a user manual for the data that you may be particularly interested in, you can ask it to help rebuild itself and focus in on that data.
I assume that's the kind of precision that you're looking for and hoping for.
Well, at this stage, and the other thing to keep in mind is just how quickly this technology is changing. And we're excited about the possibilities and at the same time cautious because it is transforming workflows. And it's something that we hope to keep building on and encourage feedback.
Yeah, it definitely feels like we're living in a very exciting transitional moment. And I even think this language around a human in the loop, right? I wonder how that's going to change in the years to come and how we'll refashion how we think about that. But it is this exciting moment of transition, and hopefully we'll have you back soon talking about a 2.0 version of this technology.
Thank you very much.
That was UH climate scientist Matthew Wodlansky. We spoke with him about a new AI tool his team developed to help his fellow scientists explore complex data. And we'll have a link to his new study on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Look at it. Look for it later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Now on view, Mary Cassatt at Work. Paintings, pastels, and prints reveal how the Impressionist transformed the course of modern art. HonoluluMuseum.org.
This Saturday, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents the Honolulu Brass Quintet. Enjoy live classical music performances with HPR every Saturday in August. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute with courses for ages 50 and older at UH Manoa, community colleges, and online beginning September 22nd. OLLIUHM.org.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson. On today's Manu Minute, we've got a bird that you might believe is a close modern-day relative of the dinosaurs. But you're sure to recognize this bird's call, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the recordings. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart has your Manu Minute.
Wild turkeys are native to North America and were imported to England by merchants from Turkey in the 1500s, which is apparently how they got their name. Also known as pelehu in Hawaiian, they're the first birds brought by Westerners to Hawaii way back in 1788. That original flock may have died out, but they've been reintroduced for hunting on most of the main Hawaiian islands a number of times since then, most recently in the early 1960s on Hawaii Island. Today, wild turkeys can be regularly seen in open woodlands and pastures, usually at higher elevations on most of the islands. Most people know a wild turkey when they see one, but males are much larger than the hens, have black and dark brown feathers with iridescent green bars, and have conspicuous patches of bare skin, or wattles, under their chin that can change color with their mood, bright red when excited, or blue when nervous or not feeling so good. Males also have spurs for fighting and a thick tuft of feathers dangling from their breast known as a beard, which is likely a status signal to other turkeys. Like many bird species, the females are much duller in color and also lack the spurs and wattle. They lay a clutch of 9 or more eggs on the ground, and the chicks are able to forage on their own soon after they hatch, but tend to follow the mother around for a number of weeks. Turkeys of both sexes make a variety of clucks, cackles, and yelps to communicate different sorts of information to other turkeys. But that gobble sound that we all associate with turkeys is actually only produced by the male, and usually during mating season, to let other females know he's in the area. Turkeys mostly eat tender green plant shoots, as well as various seeds, fruits, grain, and insects. Because they tend to only be found in disturbed grasslands and woodlands, they likely are not a major spreader of invasive plant species into our native forests like other game birds, such as the Kalij pheasant. Turkey hunting season is mostly for a month or two in the spring and is popular with both local hunters and tourists, though word is that it takes a decent chef to make them taste good. Otherwise, they're fairly bland, tough, and rubbery. As a bit of a side note, there's been strong scientific evidence over the last couple decades that birds are actually feathered dinosaurs, which means that all dinosaurs didn't actually go extinct. Even more recent phylogenetic evidence shows that the birds most closely related to feathered dinosaurs are in the order known as Galliformes, which includes turkeys. So, when you see a turkey in the wild, you might imagine you're looking at a modern-day dinosaur. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, devoted to helping protect the native species that call the refuges their home. FriendsOfOahuNWR.org.
Now it's time to pick the fruit for today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about an introduced fruit that has a long history of cultivation. People in Central America were tending to wild plants more than 11,000 years ago. Growing this fruit is now a multi-billion dollar industry. Sometimes known as the alligator pear, this fruit is more commonly called an avocado. But we asked you for a particular variety that became available to the public in 1992. This variety is an earlier fall fruit that is a Guatemalan hybrid. It was grown from an open-pollinated seedlings on an experimental farm in Puna in the 1980s. The flavor has been described as rich and nutty. As for the name of the variety, take a listen to a reaction from one visitor who tried this avocado on Kona and shared his thoughts on TikTok.
The one I tried was a Malama avocado. heals really well too. Look at that. Heals all the way. Took a little bite. Really good.
There you go. We were looking for the Malama avocado, and we had a winner, Leo in Honolulu, who's a regular listener, and he said that our hint gave the answer away. Touche, Leo, touche. And a tip for all you avocado lovers, don't pick it before it's mature. Picking premature fruit will prevent the flavor from developing, and we like flavor. That's today's quiz. Do you have one that you'd like to share with us? Write to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. With students back in school, we are featuring a local teacher who has gone above and beyond to nurture our young entrepreneurs. Chu Hong has been teaching at Kaimuki High School for 23 years. She started as an English teacher, but her newest pursuit is agriculture. The idea for a student club came to her during the pandemic when she cultivated her own green thumb. Soon after, she brought her hobby into the classroom and created the Kaimuki Worms Club 3 years ago. But don't let the name mislead you. There's much more going on under the soil. The Conversation's Laura Dukes recently took a tour of the Worms Club with Hong. We start outside Hong's old math classroom, where student volunteers had just planted a row of anthurium flowers.
Can you imagine football boys doing that? You know, and they're so delicate. And I say, treat this like a football. Don't treat this like each other. But they're so good at propagating the anthuriums, being very gentle, packing in the soil.
Chu Hong's Worms Club is much more than you might expect from the name. It's a program that's expansive in every sense, from unlocking imaginations to taking over unused spaces on the Kaimuki High School campus.
This was my math classroom. This is where I was for many, many years. And when the club started and we had over 72 kids, I told boss, you know, like, I need another room. And I know that lab is open. And
she was the old science lab, now a huge agriculture classroom.
Here's our special, special strawberry lab. We've got our aeroponic system here. Our microgreen system is going to happen here.
Outside the classroom, a worm hallway.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then we're going to get a huge one when I bring all the worms back.
And then we have to get on the golf cart.
Now I can take you to my garden.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would love that.
So let's do that. We're going to hop on. I just got it delivered a few days ago.
Oh, so it's fresh.
It's fresh. fresh. Okay, so I'm going to reverse first. So here is our off-the-grid, solar-powered lettuce garden greenhouse. So here's our solar panels. And then I'm going to show you the anaerobic digester, and then we can go in, and I'll show you the lettuce.
Hong has raised more than $100,000 in 2 years. It's mostly from grant proposals she's written herself. She drops a name to thank someone at every part of the tour.
Dr. Kakazu of Metro Girl Hawaii is our business partner. Le Ahi Juice up on Waila. Indy Jaffe. I'm going to go visit her right after this interview. Terry Kakazu of Metro Girl helped. Ulu Pono Fund definitely helped. Foster Botanical Garden.
Good idea,
Grant. Honohou Paint Company.
AC Kobayashi.
Oh, what group was it? Shucks. I work with so many groups.
It's
over.
A lot of groups.
Yeah.
Hong began gardening during the pandemic and quickly started to bring her hobby to work. But it was her students that pushed her to start the Worms Club.
And I said, well, what do you want this club to be? If you guys are serious, come up with all the ideas because I don't really want to do everything. And they said, worms. I said, well, should it stand for something or just is that all we're going to do? And somebody just said, yo, I'm going to wrap something for you. And we offer rich, moist soil. He didn't even think about it. It just came out. And I said, oh, my gosh, that actually sounds really good because we're not just doing worms. Whatever we want to do, we want to work on fertilizing the soil. Or that was a time where I was trying to garden. And so everything comes from soil. And so that was where that came from.
Hong's Worms Club isn't just about worms, but it's also not just a compost club or a gardening club. We sat down in her classroom to talk more about what she wants students to learn. What do you want students to take away from this time?
Entrepreneurship. I think I want them to think of a way that they can think of an idea or a passion and actually brainstorm and think about, well, what can I do with this idea? Because they have so many ideas that, you know, they can think about it. And if they can learn how to develop a mission, a vision, a purpose, a why, an audience that they want to sell an idea to. This came as a joke, and I told my students, if you can sell Vermicast, which is pretty much worm poop, to someone at a craft fair, and it came out as a challenge. Like, whoever can sell the most poop will win this competition. You guys are going to get a pizza party or a poke bowl or something. And I said, it's such a life skill to be able to sell trash. You can sell yourself at a job interview. You could do anything if you can sell trash. And so they took this on as a challenge, and that's kind of where it came from. And I think it's everything related to entrepreneurship, from having an idea or having a passion or networking with people or saying, how can I get money? How can I get grants? What's out there? Who's out there? And how can I make an idea become more than that? And so it's fertilizing ideas as well. And so I like the idea of, you know, this club fertilizing plants, fertilizing ideas. And eventually we want to use some of our funds to fund our students' projects in entrepreneurship. So I'm excited to see what they come up with, their Shark Tank type of projects later. But
is that something that's on the agenda for this year?
Absolutely. With the funds that we have, I want to now have a more serious group of students who sit sort of in an advisory board and decide, like, what are we going to do with our money? And I always say, you know, there's got to be a little bit for others, a little bit for the now to enjoy and have a pizza party and enjoy poke bowls, and then a little bit for the future. And so that's how I do my finances. That's how I teach my son finances. And so it's neat for me as a teacher to be able to talk about financial literacy.
What else is planned for the school year?
Yeah, so they're going to enter the American Savings Keihiko Challenge, where it's for up to $25,000, and they have to come up with an idea, and then they have to write a lot and think about what they want their funding for, how much will these things cost, why should they get funded, and it's very rigorous. And then the other thing that we're going to try to enter again is the Young Entrepreneurs Program, which is a value-added competition, which is one that we did very well with last year with our Hidden Gems project. And that was all just evolved from talking and saying, I don't know what we're going to do. And someone said, oh, what about gummies? I said, gummies, but that's all sugar. How can we make it healthier?
I think, take a step back. What was the Hidden Gems project?
Gummies that we make. And so we had a couple of trainings, and I worked with a couple of workshops from the Hawaii Ag Foundation, where I got to see this great workshop, chefs, professors from KCC, people in the industry talking about how to come up with an idea and then how to turn that into something. And so that's where I had all my students take the food handler certification test to help, you know, make some of these gummies. And it's with beef gelatin. We experimented, we failed so many times. And then working with making them shelf stable, getting it tested at the lab so that it doesn't have E. coli or whatnot. And so it was a huge process. Honestly, I don't know how we got through it, but the idea behind it is that inside this cube, which kind of looks like a sugar phenol cube, is a little ball. It's a plastic ball, but in it is kohakuto, which is crystal gummies. And that is a symbol of our students who are a little bit fragile, who are a little bit rough and, you know, rough around the edges, but still super sweet. And they're hidden gems. And I said, this represents a lot of the students here. They're hidden in the middle. And so it's kind of neat. It's like a Cracker Jack box. You eat the gummies and then there's a ball inside and it's like, oh, what is this? And it's kohakuto, which is crystal gummy. So, and that's with agar agar, which is seaweed.
What has like an experience either teaching or something that a student has done that surprised you?
I think it's when students who just are, you know, I have a no phone policy, but sometimes it's impossible to enforce that. And they seem like they're clocked out or checked out. And, you know, when there are students, groups of students who are like, oh, I don't want to go out into the garden because it's hot. And one kid just stepped up and is like, let's go, boys. Let's just do this. That's made a difference, that there are a lot of leaders who don't have, oh, I'm a leader on their forehead. And, thanking them and saying, you know, I know you're a student. I know you're doing this for a grade, but it is hard work. So thank you. So a fine balance of being the, you know, this is part of your responsibility, and then saying, but this is really hard work and you were really kind to help me out when it was really hot. And, you know, just having common sense and saying, oh, let me open the door for you because you're carrying something with two hands, that kind of stuff. Or here, give me that. And sometimes they don't seem polite, but they're like, give me that. Let me take that. But they're so sweet.
It's the smaller things. It's the smaller gestures or realizing that someone's been observant this whole time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that they're watching even though they're not, that they don't seem like they are. And so I think if you, I think if you're just consistently focused and task-driven and passionate and you have that why, like what do we do here? We convert trash to treasure and that's it. It's a simple, simple message. Everything we do is to convert trash to treasure. Your attitude, your mindset, our food, everything.
Fertilizing ideas. Fantastic. That was Kaimuki High School teacher Chu Hong in a segment produced by HPR's Laura Dukes. She tells us that the Worms Club will be selling their lettuce, gummies, and of course, worm poop later this fall. We have to go, but up tomorrow we hear from the playwright of a local theater production tackling the theme of an overbearing maternal figure. Ever feel smothered? Leave your feedback on our talkback line. The number is 808-792-8217. You can also send your thoughts via email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archived shows online by searching The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm D.W. Gibson. Catherine Cruz will be back tomorrow. Join us then for more of The Conversation.